Today is April the 10th. I'm in a classroom at Maine Elementary School talking with Diane Langfitt, who is the kindergarten teacher. Today we will be talking about her teaching experiences in the village of Norvik, which is on the Kobuk River in Alaska, and also some of the teaching here in Kodiak. Okay, Diane, let's start by just telling me a little bit about yourself, kind of like where you were born and grew up and that type of thing.
Okay. I was born in 1959 in Minneapolis, Minnesota. One of four children, and we always had a rather adventurous summer. My dad would always take 3 or 4 weeks off during the summer, and we'd head out west, and we'd go camping and hiking and live in tents for about a month. There were four children in my family, so it was a big group of us. So I've always really enjoyed getting outside and in the wilderness. So I guess that's part of why I came to Alaska. I spent my growing years in suburbia, suburban Minneapolis, went to college at the University of Wisconsin in Madison, and got a degree in elementary education in 1981. My future husband, we were engaged at the time, was also in education, so after graduating, we got married and decided we wanted to go on an adventure. And we'd looked into the Peace Corps a great deal, but then a recruiter had come through campus at the University of Wisconsin talking about educators are needed in Alaska. And we went to the presentation and thought that sounded exciting and thought, well, let's give it a try. So after graduating, we got married. About a week later, we headed to Fairbanks, Alaska, where we took a course on rural Alaskan education and were there with hundreds of other educators hoping to get a teaching job.
So you weren't guaranteed a job?
Oh,
no.
We came up more for the adventure and to see what we could get. The recruiter that had come through campus had said that they really need teaching couples. They found that when two people came to Alaska together, they tended to stay longer. They had someone there to support them and some familiarity. They also liked it because they could put two teachers in one housing unit, which was very important in a lot of places. Housing is really difficult to find. And so we went thinking that, well, here we are, great recommendations, graduated with honors, two of us married and educators, we'll find a job. So we came not being guaranteed a job, but felt that we probably would find one. And they had educators from all over the state that came to Fairbanks during those 3 weeks of that course to interview, and it was tremendous. I mean, hundreds of people waiting in line. They'd get hours behind. You'd have an interview at 5 o'clock, and finally at 7 o'clock you'd be called in. And our third interview went real well. I mean, the interviewers were organized, and they asked questions instead of complaining about all the mess that was going on.
So did they interview you together?
Together.
As a couple, okay.
Yeah, and offered us positions, and we thought, oh, no. I mean, it was Northwest Arctic Borough School District located above the Arctic Circle in Northwest Alaska, and we didn't know, and we talked to the counselor there, and they said, look, neither of you have any teaching experience. You might want to jump in and just, you know, see how it works. So we accepted that and had 2 weeks to play around Fairbanks and while we were taking the course, but then we didn't continue with more interviews and all of that stress and strain. So
what kinds of things did they go over in this course that you had to take before you were allowed to go up there and teach?
It's not a required course, but we had heard that it really gave you a good introduction, and I'm really glad we took it. There were educators from around the state, native and non-native people there talking about life in a village. They told us really down-to-earth practical things like alcoholism is difficult. It's a problem that many villages are dealing with. And we were told things like, if you bring beer in and drink, you might want to close your curtains so that nobody knows. If they know that you have alcohol, that may create problems. I mean, they got down to that nitty-gritty of just little things of what it's like living in a village, cautions. They talked about ordering food so that you could have food supplies there rather than depending on the teeny little store that may or may not be in town or open on a particular day. They went through all of that as well as education, the native peoples of Alaska. And we got to see a lot of video tape of actual villages so that we at least had kind of a vision as far as what it might look like. When we stepped off the plane in Narvik in August of 1981, there were 15 teachers in that village. It was nearing the end of the big oil money, but still we had more teachers than we really needed. There were 15 there. My husband and I were two of nine new teachers that year.
That came on the plane with you?
We were all coming in August. Okay. Actually, I think there was only one new teacher who was there before us. We wanted to get there right away and get a house set up. And many of the other people who got off the plane, the new teachers, when they stepped off, I mean, their chins were on the ground. Is where I will be living for 9 months, and I mean, I don't want to break my contract, but I don't know if I'm going to be able to handle this. Where we went, at least knowing a lot about what to do and how to survive and how to get along and what it would look like and the difficulties and the rich experiences, too, that we would be having. So I think it was really helpful for us just to get us prepared for what this might be.
That first initial shock when you stepped off the plane, was the village anything like you imagined it was going to be?
It was a lot like it, besides having seen a lot of video of villages. We had gotten pictures from the school district, aerial photographs and stuff, so we even knew where the roads were and the houses and all of that. Oh. And so, and we could see that there were smallish trees. I mean, they weren't like the trees around here, but many of the trees were, I guess many of them were actually tall, but most of the trees were probably about 5 feet tall. But so we had some idea from pictures we had gotten through
now,
the school district.
Did this start out as one of those, you stay a year and pass through and then move on to somewhere else? Was that the initial idea of when you went here, or had you planned to stay?
We came looking for adventure and with the notion that we had to stay 2 years.
Oh, 2 years, okay.
Because we felt the first year it would be just difficult getting to know the community, our kids, our supplies, and trying to get things set up as far as school goes. We also felt the money to move and the warm clothes we needed to purchase and all of that, that if we didn't hang in there 2 years, that we were really not doing it. So we came saying we really need to stay 2 years, and who knows how long beyond that. But
and how long did you actually stay there?
We stayed in the village for 11 years and would probably still be there today, except that as we were nearing our late 20s and talking about a family, we originally had said we didn't really want to have a family in the village. The nearest doctor would be, well, the plane ride was a half hour, but if there was an emergency, by the time you call, you get a pilot to fly on over and get you and bring you there, it was well over an hour. Mm-hmm. We felt with children, their health care may be difficult. There are village health aides who are actually, many of them are quite knowledgeable, and we had one in town who we trusted greatly with our health, but many, there was a lot of turnover, and many of them would have very little training. And so we felt a little bit uncomfortable about health care. We were a little concerned about child care.
Yeah, I can relate to that because I know with two small boys, I hate to even be without a car. I mean, even where there is health care, if I don't have a car, I feel like something happened, you know, what would I do? So, yeah, I can really understand that.
We had felt that we probably wouldn't stay there, that we'd probably leave before we had children. But we had been married 7 years and nearing 30 and thought, well, it's time to kind of make a decision here. Either we start a family and stay, or we leave and start a family, and we decided that we would stay longer. And we stayed until our oldest son was 4 years old, and then we had a one-year-old also. And we felt at that point in time that we really did need to leave. Although village life was good and we really enjoyed it, we felt that by continuing to stay there, that we were making a decision for our kids, that they would always be village kids. It's really difficult for children who grow up in a village to make that transition to city life. And we didn't really want to make that decision for our kids. We felt that they needed the exposure, and if they choose to return to a village, that's fine.
Right.
But we didn't want to make that decision for them. We also wanted to give them a variety of experiences that they don't get in a village.
Right. Now, with the you mentioned going in and out by plane. Was that pretty much the way you left and got to the village, was by plane?
Yeah, the main form of transportation was airplane. It was about a half-hour flight from Kotzebue, which was the local hub. We'd take a jet to Kotzebue, and then generally a 207 six-seater plane to the village. In the winter, we would sometimes travel by snowmobile and winding along the river. It was about a three-hour snowmobile ride to get to Kotzebue.
Mm-hmm.
In the summer, people would take boats, and it was even longer by boat because you could not leave the river,
right,
where with snowmobile at times there were trails that went overland, so you could avoid some of the twists and turns.
So there's like no cars or anything up there, right? It's just like strictly snowmobile. And
there were about three pickup trucks in town. The village is actually about a half mile from one end to the other, and then the airport runway is out about a quarter of a mile the other way, and there was dirt road that connected all that up, and at times very muddy and mucky, and vehicles would get stuck. But the people who had vehicles generally were ones who, like, had the airline contract.
Mm-hmm.
They had a job that they met every airplane and picked up the freight and delivered the freight to the post office or to the local stores. Most everybody else traveled by snowmobile, four-wheeler, or on foot.
Yeah. So tell me about the people that lived in this village, the native people. What were they like?
The village, there were about 500 people when we first moved in. And by the time we left, it was closer to 550. Probably 99% of the people in the village were Inupiaq Native. The other people who were non-Native were there either as school teachers or as missionaries, church people who came there to work with the church. The Inupiaq people are really in a transition. We found that a lot of different feelings from different groups of people, the elders.
Even within the Native, you mean?
Oh, yeah.
The Native structure. Oh, okay.
The elders were all very accepting of everyone. They'd bring us into their homes. They'd share their food with us. They would want to teach us their ways as well as learn ours. I learned a lot of skin sewing and enjoyed that. They've helped me with language and
and the elders, when they spoke to each other, would still speak in Inupiaq, although they had good village English skills, mm-hmm. too. The people didn't really speak or don't speak a standard English. They speak what we call village English. They leave out a lot of prepositions. They don't worry about tense. Everything is worded as a statement, but by voice inflection, you know if they're asking a question,
yeah.
or if they are giving a statement. The young people, say, especially the males, 20 to 30, had a lot of difficulty with having white people come in, making money and all.
Yeah.
They feel really trapped. They no longer fit in the traditional role of hunting, fishing, provider for the family,
right.
being enough. There's cable TV and electricity.
You're
and
kidding me, really? I'm surprised.
They got
about
cable
that.
In
wow.
the last few years we were there.
Uh-huh.
Cable TV came in. But all of those you need money for.
Right.
And the young men were really trapped. There weren't many jobs in town, so there was not much opportunity to make money. But they felt they needed to for their families and all. So oftentimes, especially after they'd been drinking,
yeah.
you'd walk down the street and there'd be things shouted at you and all that were less than polite. Because they felt that they were really trapped, and what could they do? The young women generally didn't feel that way. They still had that traditional role that they could fill of having babies and
mm-hmm.
taking care of the house and sewing and cooking and all. And so there was less resentment from the young women. They were still comfortable with who they were.
Yeah, it sounds like they're still in that, you know, masculine roles and feminine roles, and the feminine roles are still intact, but the masculine roles are kind of breaking up, or it doesn't seem like it's in the same direction that it used to be.
Yeah. Although a lot of and they are still quite traditional in their male, their views of male and femaleness. But in some ways it's changed. A lot of the leaders or people who are holding important positions in the village often are women now.
Oh.
The postmaster was a woman. The people at work at the city were often women.
Native women or?
Yeah, local
yeah.
women.
Oh.
As much so as men.
So tell me about the school. How was the school set up? How was that arranged?
Actually, there were two schools in Noorvik, an elementary school and then a secondary school. In the elementary school, when we first came, well, I don't remember how many teachers there were, maybe about five. So some of us taught multi-age classrooms, some in single grade classrooms. I began as the K-1 teacher in the school.
That probably changed a lot too, depending on the year, didn't it?
Oh,
the way it was arranged.
Every year it changed, depending on how many babies were born that year.
Yeah.
Generally, we had 15 to 23 kids in our class, just depending on how the numbers worked and how the oil money was faring. As I said, when we first went, we had 15 teachers. When oil money got really tight later in the 80s, we dropped down to, they cut us to 9 teachers. And at that point in time, it was pretty difficult. We all had around 23 kids and either 2 or 3 grades of students.
Wow, 3 grades.
With that number of students. So that we felt was less than optimum for those kids. By the time we left in 91, we were back up to about 11 or 12 teachers. So we had more students, but also the recognition that that was too severe of a cutback and that we needed to add a few more teaching positions.
Mm-hmm.
So over the course of the years, I taught K-1. Some years I taught just first grade. I taught first and second. It just depended on how the numbers worked out. By the end, though, there was one teacher per grade, kindergarten through sixth grade.
Oh, okay. And then the rest of the school was what, 7 through 12?
7 through 12 was in another building downtown, okay. A newer building. The elementary was uptown in the old part of town and was built quite a while ago and had been remodeled and was actually a fairly nice school. However, the sewer and water system was in really bad shape and there was a lot of erosion happening, and it's been on the books for a long time that they need a new school, and they've been lobbying for it with the state, and we just saw this year it's fifth on the list of capital projects and they're only going to fund four.
Oh no.
So again, they're not going to get a new elementary, but they want to build an elementary right next to the secondary school. In the junior high and high school, the teachers are basically generalists. My husband has a social studies degree, but he taught social studies, English, PE, health, math, whatever
need, huh?
They need a certain year. And they rotated a lot of the courses because there may be six teachers for 7 through 12. The science teacher one year might offer biology for high school and the next year would be earth science or whatever, but it would change so that all students would be exposed to those, but not everyone, say in ninth grade, mm-hmm. would get a consistent curriculum. Some may get it when they're in 11th grade.
Oh, I see. Now, did they go to school the same way they do here, like 9 months of the year and then the summer's off? Or?
Yep, it was the same regulations as elsewhere in Alaska. Students had to attend 180 days. We had no spring break.
This is Pierce. You have a phone call.
And we had generally a shorter Christmas break. So we would start the end of August and end yet in May. Our first year we ended May 23rd and we woke up to a snowstorm. I thought, wow, the last day of school and here we have snow. We had a number of times trying to leave in June in snowstorms that were pretty hairy. In fact, we couldn't even get out sometimes when we had planned.
So what did you and your husband do in the summertime when you weren't teaching?
We would head back to Wisconsin where I worked on a master's degree in reading education. He took courses a lot too. We But our families all lived in the Midwest, so we would spend time visiting with our families also.
Was that something that you really, really looked forward to? Like come March or April, you were like,
yeah,
get me out of here.
We weren't like a lot of people. We would often stay in the village the whole 9 months and never leave and be comfortable with that, where some people, once a month, is like, we got to get to Anchorage. Mm-hmm. Got to go out to a restaurant and go to the shopping mall and things like that weren't as important to us.
Right. Right. Did you get into the local fishing and hunting? And
We're really outdoorsy people, so we would spend a lot of time cross-country skiing. We could ski from early in October, generally till about mid-May.
Oh.
So pretty much the whole school year, we could head out our back door with our skis and our dog and just ski off in the wilderness. That was always wonderful. We'd camp. One summer, in fact, we canoed down the Kobuk River, which we went about 300 miles from the headwaters back to Norvik. But in the winter, we would also camp. We liked to go ice fishing, and we'd do some fishing before the river froze up. But like I said, we were skiing in October. The river was frozen by then.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't get into a lot of hunting. That wasn't something my husband or I really enjoyed. He went on some hunting trips, but wasn't something we did a lot of.
Right. Let's get back to the school a little bit. Were any of the teachers Native teachers?
Yes. I'm trying to think. There, in the course of the 11 years we were there, there were at least four Native teachers that I worked with.
Were they, or?
Three were from Narvik,
from a neighboring village.
Oh, okay.
A couple of them had gotten their teaching degree through the XSEED program. In that program, they stayed in the village and basically did correspondence work to work on their teaching degree. And I believe the last, I'm not sure if it was the last year, the last semester of getting their teaching degree, they traveled to Fairbanks and did some student teaching and some work on campus.
Oh.
And so that was how two of our teachers got their teaching degree. Lulu, this, I think this is her 22nd year teaching.
And she's Native.
Yeah, and she got her degree through XSEED. Two of the other teachers were young, in their early 20s, and they had graduated from one of the local high schools and went to college elsewhere, and then came back to the area to teach. One of the young women who had returned to her own village to teach stayed, I think she stayed 2 years and then transferred out. She found that to be really, really difficult.
Staying or going?
Staying. Teaching in her own village. She had her nephew in her class and other relatives too, and when there'd be a problem and she'd call the parents, she found it to be just really difficult to deal with the parents who would often be upset with her, and you're his aunt and you shouldn't be picking on him, or things like that, that she, after 2 years, she felt she just could not stay. It was too difficult teaching her relatives. Where the other teachers who are from the village were older and had been around quite a while. I'm not sure if they went through that when they were young and had just overcome that through time, or if it was kind of a changing society where teachers were now being questioned where they weren't when people started. But it was a real difficult situation oftentimes.
That's interesting, because that's, you know, even in a small village, I guess you have those same problems evolving that you do nowadays in any city schools,
sure,
too, that teachers just don't have that same, I don't even know what the right word is, but rapport or something, you know, with the way the parents are.
Right.
I don't know. It seems strange. But how about the curriculum? Were there any, like, Native customs or language? Was any of that part of the curriculum that you taught?
As I said earlier, the elders spoke Inupiaq fluently, but the people, probably 40 and under, no longer spoke the language.
Wow.
They understood Inupiaq and would use a lot of Inupiaq words. In fact, the kids that I taught, 5 and 6 year olds, constantly threw Inupiaq words into their English vocabulary as they were speaking. So I learned a lot of Inupiaq, but I can't sit down and listen to a whole conversation and know everything that's happening. I pick up on words and get the gist of it oftentimes. But because the language was disappearing and that was difficult for a lot of people, they wanted to keep their language going, but TV had been introduced, there was radio. It wasn't happening in the home,
right?
So the school board decided that they would make a concerted effort at school to try to preserve the Inupiaq language. So local village people were hired to come to school. Actually, their position was they were an instructional aide. But they would come into each classroom for 30 minutes every day, beginning in kindergarten, and they would do Inupiaq language instruction. The central office coordinated people to come and develop materials, workbooks, storybooks that were in Inupiaq. And they worked a lot on mostly on vocabulary, some on the Inupiaq alphabet. but I didn't really see that it was making any difference because the kids would, for a half hour, would practice uva una aglon, this is a pencil, uva una ilisogri, this is the teacher, but it wouldn't carry on the rest of the school day, nor once they left school.
So is Inupiaq, is it a written language? They have actually written alphabet and
words? Inupiaq was written down in the early 70s when missionaries came, and the written part is somewhat evolving. When we came, many words ended with P, and while we were there, they changed it to a Q. But they have a different alphabet.
You know, it's funny you say that because I tried to do some research on Nordic, and it's like non-existent. There's nothing written on it. But I did find some things on the Inupiaq Indians, and half of it was written with a T at the end, and half of it was written with a Q at the end.
Right, because they changed that as time went on.
And I have that down here to ask you. Which you live there, which is right? And so now you've answered it. They're both right.
They say we're Inupiaq.
With a Q, that originally had been written down with a T. But so the elders never wrote it down. Mm-hmm. It was never a part of their culture, but it has been written down. But the language is disappearing quite quickly, and it won't be too long before the speakers of the language are passing on. And there aren't young ones that speak the language to continue it.
Mm-hmm. Well, in addition to language, how about like some of their cultural things that they do? How about those? Did you teach some of those things in the school, or did you have to?
We would have what we called Inupiaq Day, probably about once a quarter, and it would be organized by the elders' council and the principal and the school board and the teachers, and we'd all get together. And during Inupiaq Day, we would do various traditional activities, carving willows into hooking sticks for ice fishing.
Oh, okay.
Women would bring in twine and show how to make fish nets. Sometimes we'd be scraping skins and talking about tanning.
Real skins?
Yeah.
Oh, interesting.
Oh, yeah, they're everywhere. That's no big deal. Generally, in the afternoon, we'd all go outside if it was March or April and out on the frozen lake and play Eskimo football, which is similar to soccer, using a fur ball, a hunk of fur that's sewn into a ball, and you run along and kick it and scream and yell and have fun. So there would be that organized activity. Beyond that, we would include a lot of what was around us, native plants and animals, in our studies. I remember my first year, I spent a lot of time outside with the kids and exploring, like when we were learning about plants, we'd actually get out there and we'd be identifying and we'd be tasting and we'd be cooking and we'd be figuring out about what was out there. So we tried to include a lot of what was there in what we did.
That kind of sounds like the hands-on approach that the urban schools are trying to get into.
Yeah. Sometimes some of the things that were brought up in school that were traditional, it was difficult to deal with because they have a lot of beliefs that date back to shamanism. And when those things would come up, I always felt like I didn't want to impose my Western views on, say, the Injikans. Injikans are what they believe are little people that are out there and hiding, and they're rather evil little beings that can grab you and take you and things like that. And they hear about it at home and at church. And
is that like, don't go outside or the Injikans will get you? Is that kind of like the boogeyman?
Something like that. And sometimes kids would come to school and say, you're the Injikan under Carter's house. I see him. And so sometimes it was difficult trying to not squelch their culture, but yet let them deal more with reality. So sometimes I felt that it was difficult to try to, you know, do I step in here and tell them of my belief? Do I allow them to continue to hear and believe about Injikin?
Mm-hmm.
That's just one example, but oftentimes it was difficult. And where do you draw the line?
Yeah, exactly. I was talking to Sarah Babbitt about when she taught in Port Lyons, and she was telling me some funny stories about how one time she had to order all her supplies, and she ordered bologna for her kids for lunch, and the plane comes in, and she gets this 6-foot-long, humongous roll of bologna that they had to cut in half to even fit it on the plane. Do you have any, like, really funny stories or things like that that you probably wouldn't have gotten if you hadn't have gone to Norvik? And you can think about it if you want to, but when she told me that, I just couldn't help but laughing. It was so funny that here she is with this, you know, her eyes are like getting this big, and carry off this 6-foot section of bologna off the airplane.
We did used to order most all of our food. There was a little store in town that had canned goods and boxed goods like macaroni and cheese dinners and all. But it was really expensive. I mean, a box of potato chips back in the early 80s was $5. So we didn't buy there too often, and we would order out of grocers from Anchorage. There were and still are a lot of grocers that they have catalogs, and you sit down and you go through the catalog and you order how many and what size and what brand, and you fill it all out and you send off about $600 at a shot. And you have to always plan about a month in advance because it takes about a week for them to get the mail and a week to pack it and then a couple weeks to get it back to you. When we had babies, that was always something that we really had to be aware of. Diapers and
formula.
Yeah, I breastfed for about a year, but then after that, you know, what are we going to need? And you always had to think ahead because if you ran out, call why. Yeah, so that was always something that was rather a chore, and I looked forward to being able to go to the store and pick it up when I ran out instead of thinking a whole month in advance.
Especially with children, you know, you never know what you're going to need or what's going to happen that's going to turn up that you want. But I don't know, when she told me that bologna story, I just cracked up. I couldn't stop laughing. I still laugh when I think about it. But. Tell me about the kids that you taught.
My kids were, well, the first, I still remember that first day of school really well. I had about 15 little kindergarten and first grade kids, and we were all sitting in a circle. And I was trying to introduce myself and a little bit about me. I was new, and find out from them. And
had they met you before the first day?
They had seen me around town.
Okay.
Some kids had come to our cabin, and so we had met them there, but I hadn't met everybody yet. And I remember, for some reason, I was asking Doug this question, and I asked him, and he sat there. So I asked him again, and he sat there. Finally, the third time I asked him, someone else in the circle said, why do you keep asking him? Well, because he's not answering me. They said, he answer you? He itnuck. And itnuck is one of their words for did this, and they raised their eyebrows, and I said, yeah, what do you mean, he hit knock, and they all start pointing to their eyebrows, and I realized at that point that not only are they using Inupiaq words, but that a lot of their speech is going to be through body language.
Oh.
And so I learned to pay attention right away to their facial expressions. If they raise their eyebrows, it's affirmative. If they put their eyebrows down, it's a negative. So right away, the first day, it was like, boy, this is going to be a challenge just trying to understand
each other.
So they
thought you were the stupid teacher.
Why did you ask him? He had not. He was answering me yes, but I didn't realize that. Because he moved his eyebrows, he was answering yes.
Oh, gosh. How about their writing? Was it different trying to teach them writing, or did they catch on to that? Did they try to write, what I'm getting to is that did they try to write their language?
They wrote the way they talked. So it was, if they wanted to write, "We go store," they would write, "We go store." And I was accepting of that. I mean, how could they write anything but how they speak? Writing is your speech written down. Mm-hmm. That was something that was kind of difficult to deal with when we'd have language experience charts that would be in village English. And sometimes I would go back and I would say, "This is how I would write this," or I would give them, I would model other ways. But they would write the way that they spoke in their village English. Yeah.
Are you still going through your
Yes. Yes. You gonna go? It's a new session. Did you pay up?
Nope.
Okay. One challenge was their language and their experiences were different than mine and different than textbooks. When we'd give the Iowa test of basic skills, I would cringe through the whole thing. Students were expected, I would read them a story about someone who had a goat and the goat replaced the lawnmower, and in the end they had to figure out what it was I was talking about and color the circle next to the lawnmower. They had no idea what that was. The next one was about a boy taking the garbage to the curb. Well, they don't have curbs, they just have dirt paths, basically. So there were often many things that were difficult because they didn't have the experiences that many 5 and 6 year old kids would have had if they lived elsewhere.
But all your materials and your textbooks came from elsewhere, pretty much, mm-hmm. right?
Mm-hmm.
So how did you get your supplies and things? Was it like a lump sum order at the beginning of the year and hopefully it would be here in time? Or?
There generally was quite a bit of money for supplies. My classroom was so well stocked when I walked in and I had lots of money the following spring to order, and we would order, I think by the end of March we had to have our orders in for the following year. Because it would take that long. But when we'd show up in August, they'd all be piled up in the hallway, and most things would be there, ready to go.
Oh, that's good. We have trouble getting supplies, and
yeah,
like you can just walk down the street and get them. But now, is that because of the oil money that you had?
Yeah.
Pretty much.
Before we went, they used to take the whole school district teaching staff to Anchorage for week-long in-services.
Wow.
By the time we got there, they were no longer doing that. And then during the time we were there, the money was cut back so severely that they made big cuts in teaching staff even. But it depended on the oil money, what you had or didn't have.
What was the entertainment in Norvik for teachers and Natives alike? What did you do to have fun? Or just
a lot of outdoor things. Basketball is really, really big in rural Alaska.
With a fur ball?
No, real basketball, because you just need a small space, the gym.
Yeah.
You only need 5 people. City League basketball is really big for community people. The high school teams were a big focal point. In fact, we watched the Norvik girls win the state title this year on TV.
Oh, wow.
Third time in 4 years.
Did you know any of them?
Oh, yeah, they were my old students. Candace Myers! Brenda Hoshi! And it was so fun. I mean, we sat here and just cheered them on because they were my old students and my husband's old students, too, because he moved from high school to fourth grade for our last, like, 3 or 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
So he had them, those girls also, so that was fun. But basketball was really big. Dog mushing races were a lot of fun. The Kobuk 440 just ended this week, and that ran through Norvik. And we would get people like Susan Butcher and Rick Swenson that would come through, and that was always a lot of fun, as well as sprint racing. We'd have high school dances once a month. That was entertainment for the high school kids. Nobody else would be involved. They'd have the lights all the way off except for a strobe light pulsing away, but we were class sponsors.
Oh, okay.
For 4 years. We started with them as freshmen and worked with them until they graduated, so we got to chaperone a lot of dances. Alcohol was often an escape for many people, and still is, and is a real problem in rural.
How do they afford that? If macaroni and cheese and potato chips are so expensive, how do they, you know, afford liquor? Isn't that
expensive? Yeah. But generally, the native people didn't see social drinking. When someone would get a bottle,
mm-hmm.
you take the top off and throw it away, because
mm-hmm.
you don't put the bottle down till it's empty. And whoever's there, it's not just one person,
mm-hmm.
but everybody drinks it till it's gone. So a lot of people did a lot of drinking also.
That's a shame.
Our second year there, we voted on the local option laws that had just been passed by the state legislature, where there are 5 different options for a community as far as alcohol. And we voted that alcohol sale or importation into the village was illegal. Drinking went underground. People couldn't openly come back with liquor on their sled behind their snowmobile. They had to sneak it in. We probably saw less people walking around drunk and in fights, but it was happening in the homes even more so, which was often upsetting when the little kids would talk about brother throwing the TV through the window.
Mm-hmm.
He was drunk and yelling at mom and things like that. And with that, the cost of alcohol, bootleggers just make a mint. A bottle of alcohol costs well over $150.
Oh, you're kidding me.
In the village.
One?
Yeah, when bought by bootleggers. No thanks, Steele. I'm busy in a meeting. We'll see ya.
Well, I know that one of the times I came into your classroom here at Maine, all the kids were walking up to me saying, "Look, Mrs. Cat."
Yeah.
So I'm assuming that came from Norvik. And can you tell me about some of the other things that you've transported from the village into your urban classroom?
I've done a lot this year because the Imaginarium in Anchorage brought an Arctic exhibit to Kodiak. And so the whole month of January that was here at our school, we all studied Arctic ecology. And I spent time in all the primary classrooms and in the fourth grade classrooms showing slides of when I lived in the Arctic, sharing language. I brought my fur clothing that I had sewn or friends had sewn for me, hats and mukluks, and brought some skins in. And I taught a lot of the language. They got a smattering of Inupiaq. We learned Nakoktuisitkokputaruk, which is head, shoulders, knees, and toes.
Oh, okay.
And we sang that. Uvlalotuk is good morning, and Uvlalutuk is good afternoon. Ilisotri's teacher. So oftentimes kids still come in and they say Uvlalotuk Ilisotri, which is good morning teacher. So I did share some of the language with them too. And that's a lot of fun. I enjoy doing that, and I find people have a lot of questions and misconceptions, and in some ways they're right on. I'd often get chuckles as I told them when I first moved to the Arctic that I lived in a cabin that was 12 feet by 16 feet, and we'd walk it off.
Total?
And that was my whole house, and I told them, "We had no pipes in my house at all." So I'd carry buckets of water home from school so we could cook and clean and have water to drink.
So your school had running water, but your house didn't?
Yeah.
Okay.
And that we had a bucket in the corner behind a blanket if we had to go to the bathroom. Kids were just amazed by that.
I think adults are amazed.
That we had no bathtub or anything. You know, you carried your water home. We chopped wood. We had an oil stove, but oil was really, really expensive, and so we supplemented with wood, and we spent all weekend out cutting wood to use to supplement the oil heat in our house. We'd have the oil heat on low while we were gone all day, and then we'd stoke up the wood fire when we were home so it'd be warm. But we'd wake up some mornings and the dog's water is frozen sitting in the kitchen on the
inside
floor.
Inside the house?
Yeah.
Did you ever have a, I read a book that was talking about the teacher. She couldn't get near the walls at night, like if her bed was near the wall.
Because
of the
frost.
Because she would stick,
yeah.
The blankets would stick, or her pajamas would stick to the wall, and she
uh-huh.
woke up.
From
was it really like that?
Yeah. We had a teacher friend in another village who, he ended up pitching his tent in the living room because the roof was so bad it would snow in to his living room. So he'd go in his tent so he wouldn't be snowed on. Housing was really difficult, and you had to live in whatever you could. And so when we first came, we were the first new teachers, and we got the best house we could find, and we were still hauling water and going to the bathroom
like
in a bucket.
A government-provided house?
No.
No. Oh.
It was a local community member's house he had moved out of, and he'd rented out then.
But no water.
No.
No electricity.
No refrigerator, no stove. We cooked on a Coleman camp stove until we were able to get an electric hot plate and an electric convection countertop oven so we could bake. And the refrigerator was, depending on the season, the honeysuckle, which is the Arctic entry.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Unheated, we would put our food in the honeysuckle that we needed cold during the fall and spring, and in the winter we'd just move it in
and it'd be cold,
put it on the floor, and it would be plenty cold to keep things nice and cold.
Now, all 11 years it was like that?
No.
Oh.
That was our
first
year, and it was really difficult with being first year teachers and having to order food and just everything
cold
else.
Cold lifestyle change.
To survive, and then all of the chopping wood and hauling water and emptying the honey bucket and all of that took a lot of time. Then that spring, some teachers were transferring out. There were two teacher housing units that were run by the school district, and many of the new teachers applied for it, and the way they have their housing policy is first if two married teachers are requesting a unit, they get first priority. Then two non-married teachers, you know, say two women, single women teachers would want it, they get next priority. Anyways, we had top priority, so we were lucky enough to get in. And then we had it was a duplex, a two-bedroom home where we had running water and a water heater and a washer and a dryer and a refrigerator and a small chest freezer. So we felt like we were living in a castle. Unfortunately, when we'd leave in the summer and we'd go back to the real world and see how most people live, it's like, wow, our place is really a dump. The floor is up all over and the paint is peeling off and the mold is so thick on the windows. But we felt pretty fortunate that it was warm and we had running water. And
what did the natives live in? Did they have houses like the first one you had, or was
very
it worse
few,
than that?
No, very few of them lived like that. The old part of the village was up on the hill, and that's where the teachers ended up living, because as time went on, the federal government, mostly through HUD, had built homes downtown. It's downtown because it's down the hill, and they had houses in rows, and they had a sewer and water system put in down there, And so as those homes were built and people were allowed to move in, that left the old, what they call cabins, because they were small and had no running water up on the hill, were then left open. And that's where teachers
and that's where
lived.
You got the first year.
Right.
Oh,
and that's
okay.
Where the teachers had to live because there weren't any of the newer homes available. They were, of course, built for the local people.
Mm-hmm.
And there was always someone ready to move in if somebody moved out.
Mm-hmm.
And they continued to build more and more HUD housing. When we were leaving in 91, they were building 10 new units, and those were all from people who were still living in homes with no running water yet that were ready to move in. And some of those were elderly people, and some were new young couples with a few kids and had been living in cabins and were ready to
mm-hmm.
move into a place with running water at least.
I can't imagine without water.
It was an adventure, and actually kind of exciting for 1 year. I don't think we could have stayed very long if we had to continue with that. It just took so much of our time just hauling water back and forth and heating it to wash up.
And your clothes, too,
yeah.
I can imagine.
Well, there was a washer and dryer down at the high school, which was a good half mile away. And on weekends, we'd load up our laundry, and we'd go down there, and we'd camp out for a few hours. But, of course, all the other teachers who didn't have running water were there on the weekend, too. And it was often a challenge to try to get everybody's laundry done.
Community effort, huh?
Yeah, it was.
Well, I guess that could be kind of like a fellowship hour.
That's true.
Fellowship 5 hours, maybe.
Yeah, except you kept thinking, I got to get out and get some more wood, or we're going to run out by Wednesday. And we're going to be cold. We had the January when my oldest son was 1 year old, we had 6 weeks where the warmest it got was minus 40. It was from minus 60 to minus 40 for 6 weeks straight. Planes couldn't fly because it was so cold. We had two babies born in town in the village because the women could not get to Kotzebue where the doctors were because the planes couldn't fly. And there was a problem with one of those births, and they got a Civil Air Patrol pilot to really work on getting this plane warm enough to get out and get her and the baby back to the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
It was pretty touch and go with them. But that was a trying time. Everybody's pipes, including the school's pipes, froze up during that 6 week period. And when it started to thaw, when the pipes would thaw, we'd find cracks and the water would be leaking into the school or into the houses, and you'd have to turn the water off and punch a hole in the wall and repair the pipe and then turn the water back on and find where water's leaking out of another place in the wall, and then you turn off the water and you punch a hole in the wall and repair that section of pipe. So that was a really tough time for the village. We didn't get food coming in, we didn't get mail.
For 6 weeks?
Well, it was about a month before we got some relief. It was a twin otter from Barrow that could fly in the 40 below range was sent down to try to help out with some of that for a little bit until it warmed up. Once it got in the minus 30, the other plane could generally fly.
Was that the coldest you ever remember at the
yeah.
end?
Yeah, that was 6 months. Dylan had a really high fever. Even with Tylenol, it was like 104,
oh,
and
gosh.
I went to the health aide, and I remember I was crying, and she came over, and we just had buckets of water there that we had carried from a storage tank at school. The pipes didn't work there, but we could take the top off the storage tank and dip so we didn't have to go cut river ice.
Mm-hmm.
And trying to warm the water enough to get him in it to try to bring down his fever, you know, because it's really cold water. And
mm-hmm.
it was tough. There were often times like that where everybody had to band together and